the microbe's vital water right through its cell wall, causing it to dehydrate. This process is called osmosis, and it can be deadly for bacteria and mold. In order for osmosis to work, the sugar concentration has to be quite high. If any water falls onto the surface of your jam, the sugar concentration at that point might become low enough to allow mold to grow. That's why it's important to take the backup measure of refrigerating all jams, jellies, and preserves once you've opened them. Like an oasis in a desert, condensed water dripping from the jar's lid can give a dehydrating microbe the relief it needs. This moment of science comes from Indiana University. Today's program was prepared by Eric Sonstrom with help from Mimi Zolan in biology. I'm Yael Cassander.
It's 2:41. We are broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication thanks to the generosity of Alice and Robert Campbell. And in sports, Lucas Glover has won the U.S. Open at Bethpage Black, getting only the second victory of his PGA Tour career. Glover finished a final round of 3 over 73 this afternoon to win by 2 strokes over Phil Mickelson, David Duval, and Ricky Barnes. Glover took the outright lead with his lone birdie of the day at the par 4 16th, and he held on, taking home the $1.35 million for the victory. He was 4 under for the championship. Defending champ Tiger Woods finished even par in a tie for 6th place, and of course that was 4 shots behind. Novak Djokovic has advanced to the second round of Wimbledon, beating Julien Benneteau 6-7, 7-6, 6-2, 6-4 earlier today. Robin Soderling advanced by beating Giles Muller. The Cardinals begin a 4-game series against the Mets tonight in New York. The Cubs begin a 10-game road trip tonight in Atlanta, and the White Sox have the day off. They will host the Dodgers tomorrow night. Interleague play sees Colorado at the Angels tonight in L.A. and San Francisco at Oakland. Those are the only two other games on the schedule. As a matter of fact, just 4 games in the major leagues, all under the lights tonight. Albert Pujols has edged past Chase Utley for the race to be the National League's top all-star vote-getter. In the results of the voting released today, the Cardinals first baseman, coming off a weekend in which he had 3 homers and 10 RBIs, reclaimed the top spot from Philadelphia's second baseman. Suspended slugger Manny Ramirez remained in 6th place among outfielders. Florida's Hanley Ramirez surged ahead of Philadelphia's Jimmy Rollins, who led for 2 weeks for starting shortstop. And catcher Yadier Molina is the only other Cardinal position player in a leading in a category. The All-Star game is July 14th. And it'll be played, of course, in St. Louis. And that is a look at sports.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department offers box lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Delivery is available at 239-5632. Strawberry Fields also offers an in-store nutritionist.
Well, for those of you who thought mermaids were strictly the realm of fantasy and Disney movies, some good news for you. They are alive and well and swimming in Florida. Well, kind of. Want to introduce you to Marina Anderson, otherwise known as Marina the Fire-Eating Mermaid. She's a dancer, fire eater, and most importantly, a mermaid. Yes, for work, she puts on a shell bra, squeezes into a fishtail, and swims. She recently did her final swim at the Wreck Bar in Fort Lauderdale, a classic tourist bar where patrons viewed her and other mermaids through portholes along the walls. The bar's closing down for renovations, and its future is uncertain, another part of American kitsch culture that could be lost forever. Anderson is hoping this isn't the case. Sidetrack host Jason Croft talked to Anderson for the June program, and he asked her first how one becomes a professional mermaid.
Ah, that is a very good question. I ask myself how I wound up doing it, too. I've been a free diver all my life. My dad taught me to free dive back in the West Indies. I'm kind of Caribbean raised. And at age 3, I already had a mask and snorkel, and I was already diving. And so breath holds and free diving was pretty much part of our lifestyle over there.
Well, what is free diving right away?
Well, it is diving without scuba equipment. It's mostly diving to depths and doing it all on breath holds. And there are different ways that people do it. Sometimes people will do it in a manner that's very athletic. They'll go for depth and time. And in my case, I kind of would do it more self-indulgently. I do it so that I can look at fish a little bit longer, or I do it to do certain movements and such. So I kind of worked it that way. And it wasn't until I was maybe in my, like, I would say maybe 8 or 9 years old when I got to go to Florida for the first time. And this was a big thrilling experience because in living in the Caribbean, I'm used to beaches, you know, these beautiful places and such. But Florida became this totally different place to me because it was all about kitsch and tourist traps. And I was completely enamored by that. So, of course, a trip to Wekiwachi became quite an event. And to see that not only were these women doing what I do all the time, but doing it as a career just totally changed my concept of what I was doing.
And then you were hooked, so to speak.
I was pretty much, yeah. And it wound up, I already had so much, you know, experience doing underwater swimming. I watched Esther Williams movies like crazy. My mother is very into old Hollywood, and she made sure that I got my fill of watching her films, and it certainly made a difference. I was influenced by Mr. Peabody and the Mermaid, not Splash so much initially. So to watch these scenes that actually wound up being filmed in Wekiwachi Springs was kind of this great little connection that wound up manifesting itself to what, you know, you see today. I'm less Daryl Hannah. I'm definitely more Anne Blythe.
And Wekiwachi was a... Explain that real quick for people who don't know.
In its heyday, Wekiwachi was amazing. They had this huge group of women that were trained. They were actually housed in the area nearby, you know, pretty much a fascinating lifestyle that these women had. And they had to learn, you know, they were going through their, they had to learn aqua ballet. They had to learn a whole barrage of training so that they could do these shows. And the mermaids themselves didn't pop up until after Mr. Peabody and the Mermaid was created, and that synthetic tail was, they allowed them to use the synthetic tail for promotional reasons, and then they wound up bringing the mermaids into the show. But at first it was all aqua ballet, and it's remarkable that to this day that theater is still there. And we're an endangered species. There are not too many of us around really performing mermaids, and especially what I do is a little different. I perform at a bar. It's an underwater bar, and this was something that was really common in the golden age of tourism, but now I believe only two places remain of this style. Of course, the Rec Bar, which is right now going to experience a renovation, which is kind of, we don't know really what the outcome of the renovation is going to be, and a place called the Sip and Dip in Montana.
So let me ask you about the tail, about the whole
mm-hmm.
costume.
Sure.
Describe the tail. Describe getting into it and swimming with it. I mean,
it's
not something that you see at all anymore.
No, it is a monofin, which is something that actually is a more contemporary style fin. It has 2-foot inserts, but it's one large fin that it's connected to. And it is used not only by free divers, but it's also used by swimmers that are training. They'll do it to practice their butterfly strokes and such. It's definitely a good training tool for swimmers as well. And they make them in different grades and hardnesses and such, sizes and such. I found a really nice one that moves very flexibly, and I thought that would really suit the fishtails because my aim was to try to look as comfortable and natural underwater with all these things that really are counterproductive to proper hydrodynamic movement. So here I am with all this hair and seashells and accoutrement, and I'm pretty much not built for swimming quickly at this point. But the whole idea is visual. So when we stop by the portholes and we pause, the hair flows in a certain way. Everything moves in a way that it looks enchanting to the viewer. They're staring at it going, holy cats. And that's what I personally was trying to go for, more of a visual art. And with the fishtails, they're all made of swimsuit fabric. They're very tight to the body, and that kind of to help with the streamlining. And I spray paint them as well to kind of give it a little extra dimension and such. But I make all the tails myself.
Hmm. Now, you're out by a pool right now.
Yes, I am. I'm always by a pool. I'm always at a pool. Right now, I'm doing some... choreography for the upcoming Hukilau event next month, and I'm really looking forward to that. So it's going to be at the Bahia Cabana pool, which is a little different. It's a smaller pool, and so this stuff is going to be a little bit more aqua ballet Esther style rather than the underwater stuff that you see through the portholes at the wreck. And I always like a challenge like that, so it'll be a lot of fun to see what we can come up with in that area.
Now, what sort of mental preparation do you go through before a swim? How do you get into character?
Usually when you have everything on, that pretty much does it. I'm always training. If I run between 5 and 13 miles a day, you know, the 13 milers I only do once a week. But for the most part, I'm constantly training weights, everything, to become as efficient as possible as far as cardiovascularly and everything. You really need to. So when you have everything on and you first put your head underneath, it's a completely different environment that you're in. So it's actually quite easy to get in character. Or in my case, I've always been a performer, so it really isn't that difficult. Once I have everything on and it's time, you can go through that personal transformation where you're like, I'm on, it's time to go, and you do it. And I train girls, the other members of my pod, I train them in that style, which is tricky because a lot of them are, you know, aren't too experienced in acting. And to act in an environment such as this, where not only are they underwater, but they're holding their breath, and to make it seem like they're not is the goal. So a lot of them, with a lot of them, it comes naturally, and then eventually, you know, just kind of step by step, they start becoming more and more fluid and more natural. And within a year or so, they do really well. In my own practice, I'm always looking at videos. I'm always breaking myself apart, trying to think what could we do to make this better physically, movement-wise, you know, with the limited resources that we have at the rec bar.
Well, here's a question. Why do you think people are fascinated by mermaids? And I'm thinking both in sort of the classic folklore sense and also maybe in the more modern, kitschy sense. Why do you think that fascination is still there?
I think, well, they're definitely, and I use this word carefully, they're sensual creatures. They definitely are. You can look at the Disneyfied version, you can look at all these different ones, and there's something very very sleek and streamlined about them. Everything about their build, their personality, their demeanor, it's never hyper or nutty. It's almost like everything is tactical, and I personally like that aspect, or I try to lean toward that. If I were to see a mermaid for the first time, I wouldn't expect her to be all, hey, how's it going? I really would like to see her just look at you going, you're in my turf now. You know, that kind of a feeling. And that's what I try to do with the wreck, because here we are, you know, being seen through portholes in a much more intimate environment than, say, Wikiwachi, where they have to be at a far distance and be seen from quite a ways away because it's in a spring. And here I'm maybe about, you know, 10 feet away, 8 to 10 feet away from them. They're looking at me right there directly or closer. And I have to make eye contact and make it to see me thorough. And I think people are very intrigued by that, because I've done performances where I'll perform in a pool where they'll see me from the surface. And I usually don't speak when I do that, because I'm too focused at that point. I really don't need to talk to people first before I go down. It makes it very awkward. So I'm thinking, you know what, I'm going to just focus and stay on my... And when people watch me perform, they start to think that I'm something else other than a human wearing a tail in a lot of instances. And they'll talk to me slightly differently, like I'm a pet or a dolphin or something. They're kind of looking at me going, oh, you know, would you like something? But they say it almost in a very... kind of the way a person would speak to a kid or a dog, you know, trying to speak to a puppy or something. I find it's really hard to describe, but I find it rather fascinating that they're taken in by that illusion enough, even though they know, technically, I've got a fishtail, I drive home, but at that moment, they're involved in it. And the mythology behind it, the films, everything that kind of, you know, all the pop culture references to it have always rather gone in that direction. The men look at it from a completely different standpoint than the women. The women look at it as things that they've always wanted to do, perhaps, or something that they've been intrigued with. Children look at it from a fantasy section of their lives, a fantasy aspect. Everybody has their own reasons behind it. And, you know, and then there are the scientists who go, manatee. So So I guess there are many different angles to be that a mermaid can be perceived from.
Well, if anyone wants to know more about you as a mermaid, where should they go?
Well, I have a website. It is called Medu Serena. That is like Medu, like Medusa. And that accommodates my fireside, all my stunt performances. That's the joke, is that I'm the Medusa. So Medu Serena. Serena means mermaid in Spanish. So MeduSerena.com, and you will find me. I have a MySpace page. If you look up Marina the Fire-Eating Mermaid, if you Google Marina the Fire-Eating Mermaid, better yet, I guarantee you'll find me, because there are not too many of us around.
And that was Marina Anderson, a.k.a. Marina the Fire-Eating Mermaid. She talked with Sidetrack host Jason Croft, and you can find Anderson swimming and performing at various spots around South Florida. Now, to make it easy on you, we have a link to her website on our Sidetrack page. It's at will.illinois.edu/sidetrack.
Earth and sky.
Futurists have predicted the end of the internal combustion engine over the next few decades. But this type of engine is still found in most vehicles on Earth today.
In the next few decades, I don't see it going away at all. I think it still will be a very relevant and probably still the major source of mobility. Yeah?
That's Jose Bravo of Shell, Chief Scientist Separations. He's one of Shell's experts on the fuels that power these engines. He spoke to Earth Sky about future trends in fuels and mobility.
Better engines, better fuels, better lubricants, lighter cars, power recovery systems like the hybrids. I don't think you will see a substantial change in the functionality of the car, because that's something that society has kind of dictated and gotten used to. But I think you will see a significant change in the efficiency and the amount of fuel that the cars require.
Bravo said to expect lower emissions from cars.
Reducing the consumption of fuel is the best way to manage emissions, and efficiency then becomes your number one priority. Yeah?
Overall, Bravo said, we should expect tomorrow's cars to be smaller, use less fuel and different kinds of fuels, and create fewer emissions. You've been listening to Shell Chief Scientist Jose Bravo. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
And in just a couple of minutes, it's coming up on 3 o'clock. And our forecast for Illinois and Indiana has heat advisories in effect for all of southern Illinois until tomorrow night, and for much of central Illinois until 7 o'clock this evening in those counties in our severe weather coverage area, for the record. Under the heat advisory of Champaign, Christian, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, DeWitt, and...